This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at two high-profile and long-standing political prisoners. We begin with the recent Supreme Court decision in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be joined by Lynn Washington, associate professor and weekly columnist in Philadelphia. We'll talk with Michael Kuzma, an attorney for Leonard Peltier.
Sadly and outrageously, Leonard Peltier, a leader of the American Indian Movement, has been in jail 33 years for a crime he didn't commit. There's still lawyers like Michael and a defense committee working on getting him out.
Stay with us.
Last week, there were two developments in the efforts to hold Bush administration officials accountable for the torture program. Sadly, both of those developments must be laid at the feet of the Obama administration and at the feet of Obama himself. The first concerns the prosecutions in Spain. Those, as our listeners may know, have been proceeding. Judge Garzón began a prosecution of six of the torture conspirators, but in particular, six of the lawyers who wrote the infamous torture memos. In the normal course of things, those prosecutions would go forward. Judge Garzón would look at those cases, investigate, and possibly may have already issued warrants. But a funny thing happened on the way to the indictments of people like Addington, Fife, Gonzalez, and others. What happens is the United States intervened in those cases. I don't mean formally intervened. Unfortunately, the Obama administration had a series of meetings with the Spanish prosecutors. We obviously don't know what was said in those meetings, but we assume heavy, heavy pressure was put on the Spanish prosecutors in their efforts, the administration's efforts, to get rid of these cases. And lo and behold, last week, when we expected a really important announcement to come out of the Spanish prosecutor's office, an important announcement that said these cases were going forward, we got a very, very different announcement. We got the Attorney General of Spain, who is a political appointment, unlike the prosecutors investigating the Bush administration torture conspirators. The Attorney General of Spain said he did not want these cases going forward. Unfortunately, we got a bad decision out of the Attorney General of Spain. He gave two reasons for his bad decision. The first was that he only felt that Spanish law ought to be extended to the actual torturers themselves. And because this criminal investigation was aimed at some of the architects of the torture program, he felt Spain should not consider the case. Well, that's obviously ridiculous. If you're going to go after anybody, it should be the architects, the authors, those who order torture. And of course, yes, you should go after the torturers, but the more important and critical people are those on the top who authorize and order torture. So the Spanish Attorney General's reasoning makes no sense. His second reason was that he felt the United States was the primary place in which the torture conspirators ought to be prosecuted. What's surprising about that is, yes, sure, the United States is the primary place where you ought to prosecute the torture conspirators. But there's two factors that are important in that regard. One is that the United States isn't doing anything to prosecute the torture conspirators. And on the same day as the Attorney General's decision, or roughly the same day, you got a decision by the Obama administration saying they weren't going to do anything. And even more critically, Spain has its own interest here no matter what the United States does. Even were the United States, by some miracle, to go after the torture conspirators, Spain still has an obligation to protect its own citizens and residents. Five of those citizens and residents were tortured at Guantanamo. So no matter what the United States does, Spain has an obligation under its own laws to protect its own citizens and to prosecute torture officials. So the Spanish Attorney General's decision is obviously outrageous. It was made as a political decision, presumably and most likely because of the pressure put on Spain by the Obama administration. Spain, which had a poor relationship with the Bush administration, wants a better one with Obama, and apparently one of the prices it was willing to pay was to get its Attorney General to try and stop these important prosecutions. But there's always an extra piece or little coda to the story. Spain, unlike many countries in Europe, has a very, very independent prosecution system. Judge Garzon was the main prosecutor here, but he referred the case up the chain to the other prosecutors to look at this case and to see whether it was a good case. All of the prosecutors believed that the case should go forward. The Attorney General said no, he didn't believe it. But the Attorney General, happily, does not control the prosecutors in Spain. He can fight it, he can take it to courts, he can do a lot of other things. But Judge Garzon and the other prosecutors still have the right to go forward. And from what we're hearing as I address this issue is that Garzon may very well go forward with this prosecution in Spain despite what Spain's own attorney general has done. We're not yet pushed out of Spain, and in fact, I don't think we will be. As much as Obama wants to do this, or the Obama administration wants to do this, I do not think it will be successful. And hopefully, we will still have a situation where the torture conspirators will be afraid to set foot on the 25 countries that make up the European Union. In a second torture prosecution-related development, probably not unrelated to the Spanish situation, was the release last week of four of the Office of Legal Counsel torture memos. Three of them were written by a later Office of Legal Counsel lawyer named Stephen Bradbury, and are really just a reworking of the infamous Bybee U memos of an earlier period, trying to still justify essentially a torture regime in the United States and abroad. An earlier memo, though, was most interesting, and that's the memo that concerns the torture of Abu Zubaydah, an alleged al-Qaeda operative. And that memo makes for incredibly chilling reading. In the most clinical language possible, page after page describes how to carry out various torture techniques, including waterboarding. It tells how wide the board has to be. It tells how much water is put into the mouth. It tells how the board is to be elevated. It talks about having a doctor or a medical person there. It does likewise with confinement in small boxes, with sleep deprivation, and in fact, it talks about 11 days of sleep deprivation being used. It's really one of the more remarkable documents, I think, that has ever been published, certainly in recent times, in a country that claims it is a democracy that believes in the rule of law. Because here you had people at the highest levels of our government writing about how to torture other human beings. And it is shocking, shocking to read. So we have to give some credit to Obama and his administration for releasing these four memos. They're available on ccrjustice.org. Read them and weep for this country, and weep particularly for the victims of our torture policy. I wish I could say there was more good news, if you want to call that good news, about the torture revelations and prosecution. But at the same time as we got these four memos released, which should scream for prosecutions of not only the higher level officials, but of the lower level officials who carried them out, you have the Obama administration and Obama himself issuing a statement that will live in infamy, that history will judge Obama very, very harshly for. In that statement, Obama goes out of his way to say that he believes, and is basically ordering, that the officials involved in the torture program, particularly those in the CIA program, the secret sites, the waterboarding, the ones referred to, the types of tortures referred to in the memos, that those CIA officials ought to have immunity from prosecution and essentially are given a get-out-of-jail-free card. And in that same release, Obama really praises the CIA agents for doing, you know, the best, et cetera, et cetera. In the release, Obama argues that these CIA agents ought to have immunity because they were doing nothing but following legal advice in good faith. The question I would ask Obama or ask anyone else who says that is, since when is it the President of the United States who decides that kind of question, whether a defendant in good faith believed that the legal advice somehow exempted him from torture laws or any other laws that one gets legal advice for, is a question for the president, or is it a question for a prosecutor, a court, a judge, and a jury? In this case, Obama has acted as judge, jury, and prosecutor, all in one. It should not be a political decision. It's a legal decision. And yet we see Obama saying, waving his wand, get out of jail free, to CIA agents who openly and notoriously tortured other human beings. In fact, there should never be an excuse for torture, whether that's a legal advice excuse or because it's an order from a superior or both. There's an absolute obligation to disobey unlawful orders. If you're given an order to execute a prisoner of war, you have an absolute obligation to disobey it. If you're given an order to torture someone, even if it's clothed in some kind of legal jargon, you still have an absolute obligation to disregard that order. We know that a number of CIA agents did. And the question that I would ask Obama is, how can you decide that these agents didn't know what they were doing, but they were simply following orders, claiming that somehow what they were doing was legal? That's for a jury to decide. It's not for the President of the United States. A final and awful aspect of the Obama statement and statements of others in his administration has been their agreement to pay for the criminal defense of any of the CIA agents who are prosecuted for their torture actions. At this point, it appears that won't be in a United States court, but this means that we will see the spectacle of paid-for lawyers by the Obama administration appearing in Spanish courts, possibly in German courts, possibly in Italian courts, or in other courts, defending Bush appointees who openly and notoriously tortured human beings. It's shameful, and as I said, history will not judge Obama kindly.
In early April, the Supreme Court denied a petition for writ of certiorari in the long-standing case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The appeal to the High Court included an examination of the so-called culture of discrimination operative among Philadelphia prosecutors. It cited 11 separate rulings where federal and Pennsylvania state courts specifically faulted Philadelphia prosecutors for engaging in intentional discrimination during jury selection. Citing dozens of court rulings nationwide, the brief noted a U.S. Supreme Court ruling where one justice used a statistical study documenting Philadelphia prosecutors purging potential black jurors at twice the rate of whites during death penalty trials between 1981 and 1997. We are delighted to welcome Lynn Washington, Jr. to Law and Disorder. Lynn is an associate professor of journalism at Temple University in Philadelphia and a weekly columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, America's oldest black-owned newspaper. He has reported on the Abu-Jamal case for nearly 30 years. Lynn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The recent Supreme Court decision refusing to review Mumia's case wasn't really all that surprising, given what we call the so-called Mumia exception. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this case has, over the years, actually over the decades, there's been one very outrageous aspect of that, and that's where courts, be they city courts in Philadelphia, state appellate courts in Pennsylvania, or federal courts at the trial level as well as the appeals level, where they will either ignore or alter their established rulings, their precedent, when it comes to the Mumia case. And some of this has been just really crazy. I mean, there was one instance in 1989 where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in February of 1989 made a declaration that a particular legal point was of such ancient origin that any time it was violated, a new trial was immediately mandated. 28 days later, when they issued an opinion in Mumia's case, they changed the law. They said it no longer applies in capital murder cases. So that's what the Mumia exception is.
And we've even heard that in the prison, photography was no longer allowed years ago because Mumia was being photographed so much.
Yes, they being state prison authorities, have barred photographing and or recording for broadcast purposes of inmates of institutions just as a way to get at Mumia, to bar him that kind of access. Now, you can go in with a notebook and a pen as a reporter, but you can't go in with any audio or video recording devices.
And one of the most blatant aspects of this Mumia exception is clearly the Batson issue, the history of racism specifically documented among Philadelphia prosecutors who have, I believe, in one statistical study, shown that prosecutors have purged prospective black jurors at twice the rate of whites.
Yes, that particular study that you were that you just referred to covered a period of, I think, 3 years before Mumia's trial in 1982 and went down another 10 years afterwards. So there was a big period, including the time when he was prosecuted, where there is compelling evidence of the prosecution deliberately purging blacks from juries. Now, as you know, there's this U.S. Supreme Court ruling called Batson, where it stated that that is illegal, that's unlawful to purge blacks from jurors for racially discriminatory purposes. And that's what the DA in Philadelphia has done, so much so that there a videotape surface of a training session, a formal training session in the office where a senior prosecutor was instructing other prosecutors on how to purge blacks from juries in a way that it would mask what they're doing and thus get around the Batson ruling. In the Abu Jamal case, again, you know, coming back to this theme of the Mumia exception, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in over a half a dozen cases have granted relief to inmates under death sentence and life sentence in Philadelphia because of violations of Batson. One of the ironies with the U.S. Supreme Court non-action a few days ago was that its precedent, its jurisprudence, pretty much comes down to if there is proof that just one black juror has been discriminated against, then a relief should be granted. And that didn't happen in Abu Jamal's case. Let me just give you one quick example. What was it, 2008? In March of that year, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a relief to an inmate on death row in Louisiana, citing Batson. And the essence of it was if there was one provable instance of discrimination against a black juror, a new trial. 2 months later, the Third Circuit ignored that U.S. Supreme Court ruling and created new law, new restrictions, higher burdens for inmates to raise in Batson cases. That 2008 ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, it was authored by Justice Samuel Alito. Justice Samuel Alito used to sit on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and he had authored a ruling raising that legal point of just one juror. So here we have not only the U.S. Supreme Court ignoring its precedent, but we have one of the justices of the Supreme Court taking a different view, apparently, on that issue now than what he did a year ago as a Supreme Court justice and a few years ago as a member of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals.
Now, that would be utterly stunning were it any other case. Unfortunately, and as you know, since you followed the case, it's been almost 30 years that you've been writing about it. Mm-hmm. It's been this way from the beginning, from the trial court ignoring, for example, the Caldwell issue, evidence of Mumia's Black Panther membership being introduced. His case was a classic textbook case of everything that could go wrong in a capital trial. How did you initially become interested in this case?
Well, I became interested in it because it was a big news story. Here we had an award-winning journalist who was the at that time the head of the Black Journalists Association of Philadelphia. Ironically, that very year that he was arrested, 1981, he was in the prominent magazine. I guess it would be comparable to the New Yorker magazine, but it was called Philadelphia Magazine. And he was one of the 81 people in 1981 to watch because he was, you know, on an ascendancy. So there was a lot of interest in it and from that respect. The other thing is I knew the guy. We worked together as colleagues. We had a off-the-job friendship. there was that interest for me in following the case. Initially, I didn't cover the case, like I didn't cover the 1982 trial, in part because, one, I wasn't assigned to cover courts at the time, but two, you know, I knew him, so, you know, there was that ethical issue. Subsequent to that, though, I have been writing about the case, and it's just been absolutely fascinating, the things that have happened with police in terms of them withholding evidence, manipulating evidence, suborning perjury, intimidating witnesses, prosecutors engaged in egregious misconduct, and judges from the trial court level all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court ignoring their duty to justice. I mean, here we had the trial court judge. Now, this didn't come out until maybe 15, 16 years after the conviction, but the trial court judge...
Sabo.
Judge Sabo, Albert Sabo, saying that he was going to help prosecutors fry, I don't know if we can use this word or not, but it's one of these pejorative words, the N-word.
Right.
So I hate to say it, because we need to hear what is actually it is, but that's a whole other issue. But he said that he was going to help prosecutors fry the guy, and this was like a day before his trial started. Let me just give you a real quick example of how the courts dribbled that matter. A court stenographer overheard this while she was going into the courtroom that Sabo was using. She was with the judge she was working with, who has not denied that Sabo said this. She came forward years afterwards when her conscience was, you know, got to her. The matter was brought to court, and a Philadelphia judge named Pamela Denby, who is now the president judge of Common Pleas Court, interestingly, she made a ruling that racist remark, that clearly racist remark, that evidence gross bias had no effect on the trial because it was a jury trial, thus the judge played no role in it. Well, the judge has a determination on what the jury hears in terms of their excluding evidence or including evidence, various rulings on points of law. This particular judge was the one who stripped Mumia of his right to represent himself. He did things in terms of helping prosecutor with the jury. So this judge played a very key role in it. And it's preposterous to say that a judge who runs the courtroom has no role in the trial because it was a jury trial. So that ruling, clearly wrong on its face, and you don't even need a law degree to see that it's absurd, it goes up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So in 2003, their ruling is, well, it's no big deal because in 1998, we ruled that there was no bias by Judge Sabo. And we dismissed claims that Judge Sabo was racist because there was no evidence. So now at the time when evidence was presented, they said, well, we're not going to rule on that evidence because we've already ruled that there wasn't any evidence. I know this sounds absurd, but that's exactly what it is. When the evidence came forward, they said, well, we previously ruled that there no evidence exists, so we're not going to deal with it.
It sounds like something out of Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland, Kafka, I mean...
We should remind listeners, if they don't remember, that Sabo was a member, wasn't he, of the Fraternal Order of Police?
Yeah, Sabo was, before he became a judge, he was a member of the Sheriff's Department, and in that capacity, he was a member of the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the union, the labor and political organization for police. But if you think that's bad, let's take it a step further. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the current Chief Justice is a guy named Ronald Castile. Ronald Castile was the former district attorney
right. For
the city of Philadelphia.
Before
Lynn Abraham. So he subsequently was elevated to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court through an election that the FOP worked for his election. They provided him campaign funding and political endorsements and everything else. When Abel Jamal's appeal went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for the second time in the late 90s, Castile was asked to recuse himself, to not rule on the case because of his role as the district attorney of Philadelphia when his office literally fought to keep Mumia on death row. According to the Code of Judicial Conduct in Pennsylvania, if a party in a case feels that a judge may not be impartial, they can ask that judge to remove himself. And also in that code of judicial conduct, it specifically says, albeit in a comment section, but it specifically says that if a judge had been a lawyer for government organization and had information about the facts in the case, they need to recuse themselves. Well, here we have the DA of the city of Philadelphia fighting to keep a guy on death row. He knew what the case is. He should have been off the case. but he refused to step aside. And then he also said something extraordinary in a written opinion saying that he wasn't going to step aside. He said that the defense is accusing me of impropriety because I took money and gained support from the Fraternal Order of Police. However, four other members of this court did the same thing. So why are you picking on me and not on the others? So here we have an instance where a seven-member court, five of the seven members took money and campaign support and other support from not only the FOP but other police organizations, and they unanimously ruled that there was not one error in Mumia's case.
Lynn, I wanted to get into this very issue of the corruption within the prosecutor's office, the police department in Philly, which has been notorious for decades. You're writing a book on this.
Yes, I'm doing a story, writing a book on police brutality in Philadelphia. In fact, the book has been written and rewritten a couple of times. The problem has been finding a publisher to, push it through. But my thesis is not just police brutality, but why we have police brutality. And the thesis is that we have a continuation of police brutality decade after decade after decade because prosecutors acquiesce in this and help in some ways to actually aid and abet it by ignoring the misconduct by officers and try to actually persecute people who are bringing those charges. And judges go along with this. So here we have an instance, say, in the Mumia case where police actually withheld evidence. They altered evidence. They went into court and offered perjured testimony. We now know this very clearly, but the courts have done what they can to help suppress that. Quick example, 1995, during the appeal, the first round of appeals for Abu Jamal, there's this whole notion about his confession. Did he confess to the killing while in the hospital? Only two officers have come forward and said that they heard that. One was the slain officer's partner. The other was one of his colleagues who worked in the same district as him, who initially said that the Abu Jamal made no comments, and then he later changed it to saying that he heard the confession. The defense in 1995 wanted to bring the other 12 to 15 officers into the courtroom and ask them why, if they heard this confession, they never reported it and had never reported it for nearly 20 years. Judge Sable refused to issue subpoenas to bring the police officers into court. He said, well, they're nice guys. Sure, they'll just come in and testify, and then we'll see what's going on. Well, they didn't come in because they weren't subpoenaed. And then Sable turned around and said that there was no evidence that the police lied about the confession because there was no evidence presented in court other than the two officers who said they heard it. It went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and it said, well, Sable was biased for refusing to order the police officers to come into the courtroom. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, well, yeah, he may have done something wrong, but he was prodded by the defense attorneys who were trying to present evidence that they only believed existed. Well, if you are blocked from bringing people in and putting them on the witness stand, and you are blocked by a judge who is biased and corrupt, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court sanctioned that.
It's stunning. If the Supreme Court had decided to take Mumia's case recently, it's likely that most of these miscarriages of justice would have come to light for many to see, including the blatant police perjury, witness tampering, and judicial and prosecutorial conflict of interest. We also knew that the attending physician, hadn't he said that Mumia was in no shape to even speak when he was admitted?
Yes, the attending physician actually testified during the trial in 1982 that Abu Jamal was so weak he could not have yelled out anything. His lungs were filled with blood, so he couldn't have spoken in any kind of tone, hushed tones or otherwise. But the jury chose to ignore that. Procedurally, there was no counter during the trial to the testimony by the police officer's partner that he heard this confession. They wanted to bring the other officer in who, 64, 72 days after the incident, changed his mind and said, oh, yes, I did hear a confession, when he initially wrote a report hours after the incident that the Negro male made no comment. Sable refused to recess the trial for an hour. This was at the end of the day. They said, well, listen, we need an hour or two to try to find this guy. Could you recess and we'll come back tomorrow? Sable said no. He actually said in front of the jury, you goofed. You should have called this guy. That's your problem. So the jury never heard this other side. Now, again, in showing bias, during the trial, Sabo recessed the trial early one day so a juror could come over to City Hall and take a test to get a city job. So when someone's life is literally on the line and they ask for an hour recess to present evidence that could possibly save their life, Sable refused to do it. However, he allowed a juror to take a test for a city job and, you know, let the jury off early for that day.
It's just
now, that in and of itself, one, shows a bias in terms of how he treated the defendant versus a juror in the case. But also, let's step back for a minute. This juror takes the test. His ability to get this job perhaps hinges on which way he rules in the case. Is he going to rule in favor of justice, or is he going to rule in favor of his pocket and the job that he wants to get?
Lynn, we really hope that your book gets published, because I think your long-time perspective on this case has to be heard among a larger audience. I'm aware that there's a petition that has been circulated, started from the German supporters of Mumia.
Yes.
We're going to put a link to that on our website. Mumia's birthday is coming up. And what do you urge our listeners to do to get involved to raise awareness of all these injustices?
Well, I would just say keep your eyes open and your ears open. There's a number of people that are, from what I understand, are trying to formulate and take actions. One is that petition that you just referenced, which was a petition to the Supreme Court asking them to rule favorably on the Batson issue, and also another pending issue where the district attorney wants to reinstate the death penalty. I also understand that there's discussions about bringing this matter before the U.S. Justice Department. A number of years ago, this was brought to the Justice Department. Justice Department officials during the Clinton administration says, well, we're not going to get involved in it unless you can show there has been some conspiracy to subvert justice. And I think we now have evidence, if not a working conspiracy, at least a constructive conspiracy that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. So if you can give a relief to a corrupt senator like Ted Stevens and say that there was prosecutorial misconduct, well, there was egregious prosecutorial misconduct in this case, give the same relief. It makes no sense on the world stage to say that you condemn Guantanamo, as you should, while you allow injustices to persist in the United States, be it Mumia Abu-Jamal or Leonard Peltier or, unfortunately, a whole host of other people, many of whom we don't even know, because their cases do not generate and garner the attention that has been mercifully received by the Abu-Jamal case.
It's really been a delight to have you with us. I know you're busy. I know Mumia appreciates all the support and writing and attention that you've brought to his case. Mm-hmm. So we hope to talk to you on a more positive note in the near future.
Okay, thank you, Heidi. I really enjoyed speaking with you and your audience. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Today we talk with Michael Kuzma, attorney for Leonard Peltier. As many know, Leonard Peltier is a Native American activist who was convicted of killing two FBI agents during a shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. He was recently transferred back to prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, after having been attacked and beaten. Peltier was also denied clemency by the Bush administration, a request that had been pending for 8 years. Attorney Michael Kuzma will give us an update on Leonard Peltier's current condition and case status, as well as offering some theories about who actually committed the crime. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Many of our listeners are familiar with Leonard Peltier's case. Could you just give a brief overview, though, of the history?
Leonard Peltier is a Native American activist who's currently incarcerated in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. They have a maximum security prison there. But Leonard was tried and convicted in 1977 in Fargo, North Dakota, for shooting and killing two FBI agents at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in June of 1975. Leonard was a member of the American Indian Movement. The American Indian Movement had been targeted by the FBI under its infamous counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO. Based on the work I've done using the Freedom of Information Act, it's clear that Leonard, along with other members of the American Indian Movement, had been targeted by the FBI under a COINTELPRO. And we've been fighting to get documents that just, you know, show how the FBI used to host the dirty tricks against Leonard and other members of AIM.
And wasn't there some confusion during the shootout in terms of other people maybe being involved?
One of the prosecutors, who's now retired, Lynn Crooks, has publicly stated that they don't know who shot the agents. There's a question as to who actually shot the agents.
Did the alleged murders come out of the occupation of Wounded Knee at that time?
No, that actually happened 2 years later.
What Leonard is in for happened 2 years later, is that right?
Yeah, that happened in, June 26, 1975.
Give us a little background. How did that happen?
The two agents, Agent Kohler and Williams, allegedly had a warrant. They were trying to serve on a Jimmy Eagle who had allegedly stolen some cowboy boots. So they came to the Jumping Bull property to execute this warrant, and a firefight erupted, and the next thing you know, Joe Stuntz and the two agents ended up dead. And then subsequently, Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler were charged with murdering the two agents. Joe Stuntz, the Native American who was murdered, that crime was never investigated, nor was anyone ever prosecuted for that killing.
Now, as I recall, Robidoux and Butler, they were represented by Bill and Margie and were acquitted. Is that right? I'm very close friends, and he founded my office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Bill Kunstler. Bill died in 95. In the last few years of his life, he worked, tirelessly on Peltier's case, tirelessly. There was an issue over a bullet in particular that they couldn't prove it came from Leonard's gun or something like that. And Bill was convinced, really reaffirming what you're saying, that they really didn't have evidence that Leonard had been the shooter in these cases.
Well, what we've discovered is that in 1977, the government merely turned over 3,500 pages of material to Leonard's defense attorneys and said, this is all we have. As a result of a FOIA case that was brought in the late 70s, we learned that the government or the FBI had 18,000 pages of material. 12,000 pages were released in full or in part. 6,000 pages were withheld in their entirety. As a result of the FOIA requests we submitted in 2001, we now learn the government actually has 142,579 pages of material. Material in every field office, the New York City field office, for example, can't even find the records. They claim they're on special locate, whatever that means. But we have a suit which is still pending. It's currently, we're waiting for a decision from the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. But in that case, there's 90,000 pages that we're suing for. The government's fighting to keep 11,000 pages from us in their entirety. The government, among other things, argued that they could not release this material because it would hamper the nation's war on transnational terrorism.
Wow. Yeah,
that's just wonderful.
Keep in mind, these documents were generated in the mid-70s.
Michael, but even assuming that he did it, what's the danger of letting this now elderly, infirm person out? What obstacles are you facing? And secondly, what's your thinking in terms of the new administration and how they may react?
Leonard, it will be 65 on September 12th of this year. His diabetes, he's not the picture of health. His eyesight's not the best. He has a number of physical problems. But there's no threat whatsoever if Leonard was released today. For listeners, the federal government or Congress abolished parole in 1984, but Leonard is what they would consider to be an old law inmate, and he's entitled to parole. In fact, Leonard and other inmates like him should have gotten definite release dates, and there's a law on the books that's applicable to Leonard. Congress years ago had a section of law that a life sentence or life sentences was considered 30 years. After 30 years, they, in theory, the parole commission is supposed to let an inmate out.
There's his issue, though, I gather, Michael, is, you know, we've handled cases like this, I'm sure you have. When you are alleged to have killed an FBI agent, that's, I don't think you ever get out. Am I wrong? I mean, I want to be wrong, but it's really tough.
It's not going to be easy. There was a recent case in New York. A Croatian freedom fighter was released. He was involved in a bombing, a Pan Am bombing, and a police officer was killed. Another was severely injured. It made the news over the summer, and it was a very similar fact pattern to Leonard's case.
Now, he should be released. I mean, he's been in now since he was 32 years old. I mean, that's remarkable. For, as you said, and as Bill really went to his grave, saying, this guy didn't do it. He didn't do it.
Michael, what's it going to take? What can our listeners do to help get him out?
Just to give folks an update, Leonard has been in Lewisburg for the past few years. Previously, he had been in Leavenworth. Lewisburg is undergoing a transition. It's becoming what the Bureau of Prison is calling a special management facility. So they've been transferring inmates out of Lewisburg. Leonard was actually transferred in the middle of January to a facility in Waymart, Pennsylvania called USP Canaan. And on or about January 13th, Leonard was brutally attacked by two other inmates. He suffered a possible concussion. Middle finger on his left hand was badly injured. You know, he was kicked on his chest and rib cage. Having headaches, his knee was bruised. So he was transferred to Canaan, was attacked almost immediately. We're not sure if, you know, what may have happened, if the guards had put these fellows up to that. He was immediately placed in isolation. He was denied actually initially an attorney visit. Eventually, we were able to get an attorney by the name of Sheila Dugan, who's been gracious enough to help out. And Sheila was able to visit Leonard. There was a large public outcry. People were writing letters. They were calling the Bureau of Prisons. And we got him transferred back to USP Lewisburg. It appears he'll be there for a while. But what we've been hoping to do is get Leonard transferred to a minimum security prison. He is eligible. He has no history of disciplinary problems. He's hoping to get closer to his family. During his 33 years plus of incarceration, he's never been near family. Most of his family is in North Dakota and Minnesota, and he's always been housed many miles away. And for example, his family just drove in a North Dakota winter to Lewisburg to visit Leonard a few weeks back. I actually got to see Leonard and his family. But Leonard wants supporters to continue to keep the heat on the BOP and the Attorney General to get him transferred either to Sandstone, Minnesota, or Oxford, Wisconsin.
Michael, where does his case stand in the courts?
Well, the FOIA case I argued on March 11th, of last year. I'm waiting for a decision from that court. He is eligible for a parole hearing. In fact, he could have requested one at the tail end of the Bush regime. We didn't think that would be a good idea. Right now, he could request one. He'll probably be requesting a hearing in the not-too-distant future. There's really no other pending court cases other than the FOIA case I just mentioned. The parole hearing will be upcoming, and I can assure you the FBI will once again engage in a massive disinformation campaign once a date is set. They've done it in the past, and I have no doubt they'll do it again.
Michael, do you have a website, or does the Defense Committee have a website that we can tell people about?
Yeah, the website, the official website is www.whoisleonardpeltier.info. That's a great site that's run. Right now, the Defense Committee is run by Leonard's niece, Carrie Ann, and his sister, Betty. They're both in Fargo, North Dakota. If you go to that website, you can get Leonard's mailing address, his contact information, and what people can do to help out the case.
Michael, we're interested. How did you initially get involved in this case?
Well, for years, I actually would write letters, and I remember going to Washington one spring, and we were lobbying members of Congress. That was the extent of my involvement. In the spring of 2001, Gina Chiala, who was the director of the Defense Committee, asked me if I would take over the FOIA request. Jennifer Harberry, who had been involved previously, was busy working on her own case. Listeners may know that Jennifer Harberry's husband was murdered by U.S.-trained military personnel in Guatemala. So Jennifer had a case pending in the Supreme Court, and she was, you know, preoccupied with that. So what I did is I looked over what Jennifer had submitted to the FBI under FOIA, and I coordinated efforts to obtain Leonard's files under the Freedom of Information Act. And I've been doing that since the summer of 2001.
It's still one that, you know, sears my heart, having known Bill so well and what it meant. And that Leonard, when you think about it, an innocent man doing 33 years and one of the, you know, the real genuine leaders of the Native American movement in this country.
The tragedy, too, is the lead attorney, Elliot Takeoff, had turned out never tried a murder case before. I mean, that's one of the things.
I didn't know that.
And then, and then Bruce Ellison, who I love and respect, he was fresh out of law school back then. So you have an lead attorney, hadn't tried a murder case. You have a young kid fresh out of law school. And then you have an unfriendly judge and a hostile Lynn Crooks and company, just they had a field day. And then there was this whole climate of fear. The FBI had the judge, they were debugging the chambers, and the jury was brought in. They had their bus windows blacked out or blocked out because there was all kind of hysteria whirling around this trial.
And then there was the issue that I asked you about before, but I'm trying to remember, that when Bill took over the case, in some way it was on a habeas. You know, I think he'd already lost all the appeals, and it was on the bullet issue. And can you tell me something about what happened? There was something about the bullet not matching.
Apparently there was an AR-15 that was linked to Leonard Peltier, and there was a ballistics report that was withheld from defense attorneys in 1977. That ballistic report was unearthed by John Privatera, who was involved in the case. He and Michael Tiger had filed a FOIA request and subsequent lawsuit. And this ballistics report, which was withheld at the time of the trial, showed that the gun, the AR-15 connected to Leonard Peltier, couldn't have possibly fired the fatal shots. And that report wasn't available to defense attorneys in 1977. And that's when Bill Kunstler brought that habe.
So you mean to say that at the trial that there was a gun that they attributed to Leonard and that they must have claimed was one of the weapons that killed the FBI agents. Is that right?
Correct.
And they didn't have a ballistics report that basically said that gun, the bullet didn't come from that gun.
Yeah, that report had been withheld in 1977.
The defense didn't have that report.
Correct.
So, I remember when Bill lost this case after the hearing. It seemed astounding to me. I can't even understand how he could have.
Well, I think the Eighth Circuit in that case, Judge Haney, who's actually spoken out and written letters on Leonard Peltier's behalf, he was part of the panel, was actually interviewed on a now defunct CBS program called West 57th. Steve Croft was the host. But they didn't feel that report, although would have been helpful, would have, you know, changed the jury's verdict. But Judge Haney indicated it was the toughest decision he ever rendered. Haney, I might add, and I've learned this through the documents we've obtained under FOIA, he was actually approached by the FBI after he started writing letters and speaking out on Leonard's behalf. I think he's in his upper 80s or might even be 90 plus now, but I think that would be pretty intimidating to have a couple of FBI agents banging on your door just because you wrote a couple of letters on behalf of Leonard Peltier.
This is a circuit judge.
He didn't hear as much from Judge Haney after that visit.
That's a circuit judge who they're doing that to. Yeah. That's incredible.
Correct.
There's no way, I think, for this government to argue that we don't have political prisoners in this country after a display like this. We're speaking with defense attorney Michael Kuzma. He's representing Leonard Peltier, also pronounced Peltier, and the website is www.whoisleonardpeltier.info.
I have a final question, Michael. Through your readings, is there any evidence to point to the real shooter, or do you have any theories about that?
Well, what I always find fascinating, and no one really talks about it, neither the FBI nor even the old AIM members, when Leonard was arrested on February 6, 1976, he was with an individual by the name of Frank Blackhorse. Now, Blackhorse was also the FBI wanted to talk to him about the shooting deaths of agents Kohler and Williams. He was also under indictment for wounding Special Agent Curtis A. Fitzgerald at Wounded Knee in March of 73. And he was wanted in Wisconsin for obstructing a police officer and carrying a concealed weapon. Lo and behold, Mr. Blackhorse is never extradited back to the United States. The Wisconsin authorities dropped charges within 3 days. He's never brought back for the shooting Special Agent Fitzgerald. And I might add, Agent Fitzgerald never fully regained the use of the one hand that was wounded. And he's never brought back to be questioned about the deaths of Kohler and Williams. Well, it turns out Frank Blackhorse isn't Frank Blackhorse. His name is Frank Leonard DeLuca. And to this very day, is a free man in Western Canada. And wow. I always found that very curious about the case. Who was this guy? He uses the name Frank Blackhorse. He's Italian-American, no Aboriginal blood whatsoever. He wounds one FBI agent. The FBI wants to talk to him about the deaths of two others, but yet he's allowed to roam free throughout Western Canada. That's, to me, one of the most curious things about this case.
It's curious, but it's actually in this period, maybe even today, of course, still, but there was huge infiltration into the American Indian movement. I remember there's a trial that Bill did of for the occupation of Wounded Knee.
Russell Means and Dennis
right.
Banks, Douglas Durham, the head of security for the American Indian movement, was a paid FBI operative.
So was the head of security for Malcolm X.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, in this FOIA case, which is pending in the Eighth Circuit, there's 11,000 pages the government's fighting to keep from us. Now, the biggest portion of this file is the sub-N file. That's the informant file. And the government is fighting tooth and nail to keep that from us. They're fighting so hard, they would not even give us the dollar amount that they spent on informants back then.
Oh my God.
I'm convinced that we would discover that informants got close to defense attorneys. In fact, they were going to dust off Douglas Durham and use him in the extradition process. In fact, they had him waiting in the wings in Leonard's case. So I think the reason the government's still fighting so vigorously after 30-some-odd years to keep this material from us, which should have been turned over in 1977, or even when John Privitera and Mike Tiger brought that suit in the late 70s, but they can't afford to have this information come out, because if people learned, you know, how extensive this network of informants and undercover agents was, people would just be outraged. Really, what I think you will learn eventually, and the truth will come out, is that the FBI's COINTELPRO activity set the wheels in motion, which culminated in the deaths of Joe Stuntz and the two agents.
You know, we couldn't agree more, and I really, it's an honor to speak to you, because, you know, a lot of people you know, they give up at a certain point. And I know Leonard hasn't given up.
I never give up.
I know, and you, I know Michael won't. So I think it's really moving to hear this.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you, hopefully, when you get those files.
Hey, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.